This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the show. Today, I am once again joined by one of my favorite people in the whole world, Dr. Emma Cahill Morón, to talk about another member of the Spanish monarchy.
Today, big surprise!
And today we are talking about Isabella of Portugal. Emma, welcome back.
Hi. I think it's going to be a wonderful day because this is an amazing woman and with many connections to England too. So we're never far from England and the Tudors, are we?
Oh, you already have me intrigued because I really do not know much about her. We've already talked about her sister, Catherine, and her other sister, Juana. See, I'm getting better.
Her aunts.
Am I confusing myself here?
A little bit. So let's start telling everyone who Isabella of Portugal is, right?
Because I don't know.
She is related to Catherine of Aragon and Juana of Castile. But she is the daughter of another of the sisters of Isabella of Castile, of Maria of Castile and Aragon, known a little bit more as Maria of Aragon, who was queen consort in Portugal, and Manuel I. We talked about Manuel I when we talked about Isabella of Castile. So Isabella is the daughter of one of Catherine of Aragon's sisters, the one that went to Portugal and became queen consort in Portugal. So Juana of Castile is her aunt, and Catherine of Aragon is her aunt too. That's Isabella of Portugal. She's the daughter of Manuel I of Portugal, the king of Portugal, and Maria of Aragon. She's usually known, and we can talk about names because this is a bit confusing, I know.
Yes,
all
can
Catherine's,
we?
Catherine's, Maria's, Isabel's. That's all we have.
Yeah, because
The names get confused.
Yeah, because we hear Isabella and then we hear Isabel. And which is it? Is there a proper way?
Oh, my. Every time I try to write something or tweet something, I doubt because it's a complex, complex thing. Happens the same with Catherine of Aragon. For example, when I did my master's dissertation, I called her Catalina Trastámara because she's from the Trastámara house. Like you would say Arthur Tudor, right? Because I was using the name convention Arthur Tudor for him. I thought, well, I use the same. Nobody has checked that publication ever because that name just doesn't go, for people, doesn't ring the bell that it's Catherine of Aragon. We call her Catherine of Aragon because she, for the longest time after Isabella of Castile dies, she is the daughter of the King of Aragon, and she becomes the ambassadress of the King of Aragon, Catherine of Aragon, Catherine of Aragon, Catherine of Aragon. But really, she was in the time in Tudor England, for example, she was known as Catherine of Spain because her mother and father are the first, well, before we have some presidents, but they are the first king and queen of Spain. So, for example, Thomas More in her coronation poem calls her Catherine of Spain. But we call her Catherine of Aragon. In the case of Isabella of Castile, we have the same problem. Isabella is not a Spanish word. It's an Italian word. Like Isabella d'Este. In Spanish, her name is Isabel. But because of this, the Southern Europe was like, kind of is always like, oh, Italy, Spain, we'll all put them all together. So someone named her Isabella of Castile at some point in time, and it just caught on, and that's how we call her. But for example, Isabella of Castile is Isabel, Isabel. And in this case, she's Portuguese, Isabella of Portugal, despite the fact that she has a Spanish mother, but she was born in Lisbon, is Isabel We call her in Spanish La Emperatriz Isabel because she became not only Queen of Spain, but Empress of the Holy Roman Empire. So they're confusing with the name conventions, right? We'll stick with Isabella of Portugal because that's how people know her, I think. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea. Yeah. I definitely do. Well, let's just get started from the beginning with her because I clearly know nothing about her. I made that pretty clear from the opening of the show.
She's fascinating and you love her. And I think you will realize that you know a lot about her time. And it'll be great because then you can picture her in different places. And when I was doing a bit of research, I know her biography more or less, but I put it in context with the Tudors was great exercise for me. She was born in Lisbon on the same year Catherine of Aragon was betrothed to Henry Tudor, to future Henry VIII, so 1503. She was born in Lisbon to these kings that I've just said, king and queen, Manuel I and Maria of Aragon, Maria of Spain. We know who, Catherine of Aragon's sister, right? She was born to those. And the important thing, she was born in Lisbon, and you guys have to put Lisbon in your bucket list. I know I always tell you to travel to Spain, but Portugal's right next to it, and it's amazing. Manuel I and Maria of Aragon founded the monastery of Jerónimos in Lisbon. That is one of these places that will make you cry when you enter this place because it's just out of this world. It's in the late Gothic, very, very decorated, ornamented style, the architecture of the monastery. When you go and see the cloisters, you're just going to be blown away. And you'll be thankful that I told you to go there because it's amazing. If you do decide to go, there's big lines. So I would recommend to probably, I think you can buy your tickets beforehand. So if you do go to Lisbon, please, please, please go there because, well, go to Lisbon. Lisbon is amazing. So that was founded, that's how the type of court where she was being raised. She was raised in a court that was flourishing with Renaissance. So Isabella of Portugal from childhood was educated in the same style that Catherine of Aragon, we've talked about this before. We have to think that her mother was the sister of Catherine of Aragon that learned with Catherine of Aragon, with Alessandro Geraldini, that Italian humanist that Isabella brought to train and educate her two youngest daughters. So Mary of Aragon and Catherine of Aragon were very close. They were very close in age. So they were the two sisters of Isabella of Castile that always learned together. So sorry about that. I think I just got an email. So yeah, this is the case. That these two sisters were very close. So for example, Isabella of Portugal's education would have been very similar to Mary Tudor's education. Think about it. The mothers were sisters. But not only that, the lives of Mary Tudor and Isabella of Portugal are intertwined a lot more than you'd think, because Isabella marries Emperor Charles V, her cousin, Mary Tudor's cousin, and Mary Tudor's fiancé. Between 1522 and 1526, Charles V was betrothed to Mary Tudor, to his cousin, to his English cousin. But because she was still a child and he had to have an heir and they were pressuring him, he decided finally to marry his other cousin, Isabella of Portugal. So then we see that they're already connected to the Tudor court. This is, you know, the Tudor court in this time is a European court. Later on, not so much, but in this time, you can't understand the Tudor court without all these other courts. The Portuguese court is very important, the Spanish court, of course, and the courts that are linked to those, which are the Netherlands and the Holy Roman Empire right now. So basically the whole of Europe.
Can we, I know people are going to ask this question and some people already know the answer to this, but can we talk about why they were always marrying their cousins?
Well, that's a good question to ask, because why would you marry a cousin, right? We like, bleh.
Especially a first cousin.
Yes, especially a first cousin, of course. Think about this. Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand were already cousins. They were from the same house. This was a strategy. This was a strategy, a dynastic strategy. It was to tighten the dynastic lines together. And if you think of it, We talked about this when we, so you'll have to go, and everyone who's listening to this will have to go and check out the episode about Isabel of Castile, because we talked about this too, to tighten these this house together, the Trastámaras. We're thinking of even tying up with the Portuguese, so under one monarch would have been Portugal, Spain, and not Spain, Aragon and Castile. So this is why they're marrying the cousins. So, for example, Isabella and Ferdinand, the first alliance that they establish is with, always with Portugal. Their eldest daughter gets married to the king of Portugal, the same Manuel that would later marry Mary and would have Isabella of Portugal. So this is the reason why. It's because they are trying to, it's a strategy used not only by the house of Trastámara, but then when this house gets interlinked with the Habsburgs, oh boy. These guys love it too. So they just teach each other how to do it even better. So yes, it's always the first cousins are the first options. And you have to think that in the case of, for example, Mary Tudor, we have to realize she was she was going to be Queen of England, because Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII didn't have other children. By the time she was betrothed to Charles V in 1522, everybody knew that she was going to succeed her father at that time, because we know what happens. But so Charles is ambitious. He's like, great, this cousin has a lot of things to bring to me, because this is not, we now think of Germany and Spain, but these are monarchs that are accumulating power. So if Charles would have married Mary Tudor, the Tudors would have ended, really, because the Habsburgs would have started in England. So it's just a strategy to strengthen your personal power by becoming king of more places and have more titles. This is a strategy. It's a good strategy. It worked for them until the inbreeding, you know, did its thing. And that wasn't, you know, the best, the highlight time of the Habsburgs. But
that's the understatement. Until the inbreeding happens.
Until the inbreeding got too bad.
Yeah, until the after effects of inbreeding showed themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. And even Charles V, you know, he's well known to be someone that was already showing that inbreeding, because he had a huge jaw that was dropping. Like, they describe him not being able to close his mouth because it doesn't fit. His lower jaw is so massive. He had problems to speak even. That's why he grows a beard, because, you know, a beard is the maquillage for men, right? Mm-hmm. So he grew a beard to hide this huge chin that he had because of this inbreeding, really.
Okay, so of course now I have a weird question for you.
Oh, I love those.
This always happens. So Charles V had some signs of inbreeding. Were there any women during that time in the family that showed it? Because I feel like we don't hear about that until later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There's two things to consider about this. One is that, yes, they are related cousins. So, yes, the women had not as much as he did, but there's descriptions of the women had it in his family, yes. But then we have to think that also we know the physical appearance of these women because of portraiture, but portraiture is not a picture. Portraiture can be altered to look like a certain way or do certain things for you, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in the Renaissance, I think that because portraiture is becoming so realistic, we think we are seeing the real people that were at the time, but we're not. Most of the times, we're not. So in the case of Charles V, we go from, for example, there's a portrait of him in the Royal Collection Trust that was painted for his betrothal to Mary Rose Tudor. So Charles V is also very connected to the Tudors. She had it in her possession in 1514, and you can see his jaw is just out of control. And then when you see him painted by Titian is a year later with his beard, his maquillage, he looks like totally different, but his chin is not as big. So it's clearly Titian has, and this was a technique. It was a technique to show people more than monarchs, more than in a real way, in the way that they wanted to project themselves. And Elizabeth I of England does the same thing with her mask when she's, you know, 80 years old, but still being portrayed as someone who's younger, which is, I think, is very, I'm going to start doing that, I think, too. it's just using filters, right? So what I was trying to say is that sometimes those women are depicted like the men and have those chins, and we don't know if it's real or not, because maybe it's just a way to show they are part of the family. We know that some queens were painted to look like their husbands. Like, for example, in the case of Maria Luisa de Orleans and Charles II of Spain, when she comes from the French court and she starts being painted in Spain, her features look like the features of the king. It's a strategy. It's a strategy to show like an image of power, of that you are connected to that dynasty, to that king, to that. So we're, you know, it's tricky. This, did other women have it? Some did, and some were just, would be depicted like that. A very specific case is Catherine of Aragon. It has been said that in her family, this run too, but I haven't found any evidence in her portraiture that we know was painted from the life that she had this chin. Quite the opposite. She looked a lot like her mother, who had quite a little chin. But then she was depicted in other artworks with this Habsburg chin. But Catherine of Aragon was not a Habsburg. She did not have one drop of blood of the Habsburgs. She was a Trastámara. So I haven't found evidence that this ran in the Trastámara family as much as it did in the Habsburgs, where it was very evident. So these depictions of Catherine of Aragon looking very Habsburgy are a strategy, really, because they are from the 1530s.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, I always have a way of sidetracking us a little bit, don't I?
Oh, portraiture? I can be sidetracked in portraiture for the rest of my life. Don't worry about it.
Well, let's get back to Isabella and her early years. So we know she was well-educated. Mm-hmm. How soon was it that she was betrothed to somebody? Because it always seems like these princesses are betrothed at a very early age for these alliances. When do we see this first for her?
So because she was Manuel and Maria had many children, and Isabella was the first girl. So, you know, as we've talked before too, the first girl is always like is the first one to get the attention from suitors, because potentially, especially in the Iberian kingdoms where the women can succeed, they become very, very very good suitors for other, but I think in her case, it was, she grew up, I don't know of engagements of her before Charles. So we have to think that she was married to him. So she was born in 1503 and she married him in 1526. And really, I'm trying to read here, and no, there wasn't, wasn't many other suitors for her other than Charles.
Oh, weird. Why do you think that is?
Because Portugal always wanted the alliance with Spain. So mm-hmm. they knew at some point, they just knew they had to raise her to be a Spanish Infanta. Portuguese Infanta, Spanish Infanta is a very similar thing, especially when your mother is Spanish and she's teaching you, right? Because Maria of Aragon. So I think it was just a matter of when the right time comes. They always thought the ideal candidate was her cousin Charles, because think about this, Charles and Isabella are of a similar age. Charles was born in 1500, Isabella was born in 1503. Mary Tudor was born in 1516. So it's not that Charles preferred one or the other, it's that just when the right time came, this is the cousin that is closest in age, so this is the one I'm going to marry. So I think she was just raised with the idea of that, so that's why she doesn't have other suitors, really. She's just being raised to marry the next king of Spain. Yeah, and she does.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So do we know, did she know Charles before they were linked together that way?
Yeah. So Charles is well known to have traveled throughout Europe, went before. So Charles does not visit Spain on the Iberian Peninsula until he becomes king of Spain. Later, because, I mean, and he's even accused of not knowing Spanish. So until he arrives to Spain in 1518, he wouldn't have been able to meet her. And now I'm not sure, but I'm sure there was portraits sent and they were very close by. So yes, I'm sure he met her before. There was portraits of her mother, of her family. This was the closest court. They had been ambassadors coming at the second he arrived with portraits of her. But the thing is, he doesn't... Charles V does marry Isabella, falls in love with her. She was known to be very beautiful. She was known to be very beautiful, and he falls in love with her. And she is a very successful ruler, because the thing with Charles V is he travels a lot. And because he becomes Holy Roman Emperor, he travels a lot around Europe. And Isabella stays and becomes governor of Spain and does a very good job. So she's not only beautiful, she's powerful, and she is doing a great job. And she helps him in many, many things, amongst which is helping her with the King's Great Matter in England, helping her own aunt, Catherine of Aragon, gather all these documents to help her in the Blackfriars trial to prove the Spanish side of the story.
I didn't know that.
Well, I'm gonna send you a publication that came out in December in the Royal Studies Journal. It was called "Tudor Sexualized Bodies." It was edited by Valerie Schutte, and I wrote a piece on questioning an honest queen, questioning Catherine of Aragon, because we have tend to hear the story from Henry VIII's side and the evidence that he was that he gathered. But in Spain, they did a great job. They also gathered evidence. They also gathered witnesses, testimonies. But because this was written in Spanish and stayed in Spain, it hasn't been used. It was a little bit used by Giles Tremlett, but now amazing work by people like Sergio Bravo, by Julia Benavent, who has published the documents where we have the evidence, the questions that were asked to the witnesses that had been with Catherine at the time of Arthur's marriage. So they were first-hand witnesses, all the information that they gathered, and how that when Charles sends the order, Isabella just puts this whole thing to work, and they just go in the archives and find tons of stuff. They find everyone that they're looking for too. So this just tells you how organized the Spanish monarchy was and how powerful the Queen's orders were, right? She's not only Holy Roman Empress, she's Queen of Spain and governor of Spain while Charles is away, and she does things like this. She also helps him a lot with all his policy in the Mediterranean, and she consolidates this a lot. And she is very good at something that women are very good at. She's very good at keeping the grandees, the great noblemen of Spain, at bay. And this is not something I know. This is something that Sergio Bravo has told me. So he's a specialist. He's doing his PhD on her role ruling Spain during the absence of Charles V. He's doing a great job. And I asked him, what would you say are the two biggest things? And we also know a lot about Isabella in the artistic front, because there has been a researcher, Maria José Redondo Cantera, for many years, has pointed out that Isabella had, you know, was very active in terms of artistic patronage, and she liked very luxurious things. So she's overall a very amazing woman.
DirecTV Stream has the most local MLB games, which means it's never been easier to
root for the home team.
So whether you're rooting for a aura,
safe,
or even a
strike three,
or
it's out of here,
root for your home team with DirecTV Stream, the most MLB games, period. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I'm glad you brought up the arts, because that was exactly where my mind was going, comparing her to the other family members that we know were very big into the art scene and, you know, learning how to paint and things like that. Is there anything about her patronage to the arts that we should know about?
Yes. So, well, for example, or something that is curious, and also Sergio told me about this, so this is Sergio, not me. She was the one, and I think this was published by Maria Jose Redondo Cantera, is a specialist in Isabella's artistic patronage, if anybody wants to check that out, from the Universidad de Valladolid. And she was the one to start the collection of relics that would be famous in the reign of Philip II. So all types of objects from saints and exotic things that would arrive, she was the first one to put all that collection that later Philip II would have. And because Philip II is her son, Philip II of Spain is her son. And then he marries Mary Tudor. I know what you're thinking. Wow.
You can just see my face. Like, here we go again.
I was like, oh, these people are great in some ways, but in others, yeah. She's, and then when she tragically dies very, very young, because she dies in 1539, so she was only 36 years old, it's curious that, you know, Charles didn't have a portrait of her. And he's very upset because he loved her very much. So he tells his main artist, Titian, one of the greatest artists of all time, that was working mainly for Charles V, to paint a portrait of her to remind him of her, because he doesn't have one. And Titian does this beautiful, amazing portrait that is sitting, is hung next to the portrait of Mary Tudor in the Prado Museum, because it has that same model. The queen is sitting. She has a beautiful dress on. It's it's whimsical in a way, you know. It's very airy, and it's very, and this is because it's not really a portrait painted from the life. This is how deceiving sometimes Renaissance portraiture is, because you do think it's her, you know. You're like, oh. So and then in the Prado Museum, they also have a sculpture of her. A very beautiful sculpture of her made in Carrara marble of the Empress. And if you want to really go and talk to her, you can always visit her at her tomb. She is in one of the most outstanding places in Spain, in the monastery of San Lorenzo del Escorial near Madrid, that was founded by her son, Philip II of Spain. It is very beautiful. It's a beautiful place. And now you can take pictures. Now you can take pictures in all of the places of Spanish National Heritage. I mean, maybe to some people it's like, okay, but to us Spanish people was like, what? And everybody ran to take pictures in all these amazing places. We have a heritage in Spain that is just out of this world. And if you have time to go to San Lorenzo del Escorial, you will thank me, because this place is just out of this world. And in that place, I'm sorry, it's not about Isabella of Portugal, but this is very interesting. In the library of San Lorenzo del Escorial, they have the first translation done from English into Spanish known on record, commissioned by a certain Catherine of Aragon. I know. I always talk about the same woman. But she commissioned this when she was still Princess of Wales in 1508. And it's a story, is the history of England. So it's a translation of the Chronicle of St. Albans, but it's not just the Chronicle. She asks her secretary, Rodrigo de Cuero, to translate this into Spanish and end it with her own coronation. That's 1508. So she's basically killing off Henry VII. Before he's dead.
Interesting.
Isn't that crazy? That's the first translation on record from English into Spanish. Isn't that crazy? And it's a history book. It's a propaganda book of Catherine of Aragon, basically.
Right.
Because if it's translating that chronicle, but adding the last chapter, her coronation, before Henry VII is dead. I mean... Wow, lady, you have some guts, because that's treason, I would think.
Yes,
right?
Imagining the king's death is
then
definitely...
Nobody understood it because he was writing it in Spanish. So nobody was like, oh, what is he doing? I don't know. He's writing some words there. I don't know.
No idea what it says. That's crazy.
It is.
Thank you for that little tidbit of information there, because that's something I have never heard before. And I also... did not know that that portrait of Isabella was posthumous. That is one of my favorite ones. When I look at that, she is just absolutely stunning. And now it makes sense. It was his way of honoring his late wife.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was truly devastated when she died. He was truly devastated. He hadn't had a lot of time with her because he had to be traveling Charles V was a monarch that traveled the most around Europe. And he was very grateful to, and you know, Charles gets a lot of bad press, but Charles was, because he was brought up in this very female, this very feminine environment, he shows a lot of emotion for all these women. He takes the portrait of Mary Tudor with him to when he abdicates and he goes to a monastery to just spend his last days. He takes a portrait of Mary Tudor that he never married. Charles, you know, he was like, so he was kind of in love with both of them, I think. Not in love, just respected the women in his family, because I think he realized that the Spanish monarchy was as powerful because these women were very useful and were helping them a lot. And Mary Tudor was part of that. And he asked his own son to marry her because of this, you know? So because he felt so bad of what happened to her and her mother when he decided to marry Isabella of Portugal, let's face it, this is probably the most interesting part about Isabella's life for someone who's interested in the Tudors, is that she felt, that's why she helped her aunt so much later, because they felt awful about what happened to Mary and Catherine. Think about it. It's 1526 when they get married. Yep. That's the same year that everything goes down, right?
Yes.
So basically, this is how I think it went down. I'm just going to clear the air in 1526 right now.
Give it to us.
I just think, you know, Henry had high hopes that Charles was going to marry Mary because he had a lot of confidence in Catherine of Aragon's abilities as a diplomat and her way of not letting go when she decided something was going to be done. Charles marries Isabella of Portugal and Henry VIII loses it. I think that's why he decides that he doesn't want to be, Catherine is of no use to him anymore. And he doesn't have a son.
Right.
So I think this is why he decided to, not because he was in love with anyone else. I think he decided, you are not useful to me anymore because you had to do one thing and you couldn't do it, basically.
Yes.
Exactly.
Wow.
Catherine had negotiated marriages for Charles since before Henry VIII's reign, when she was an ambassador with Henry VII. In 1508, that same year that she tried to kill off Henry VII, she negotiated marriage to marry Charles, not Charles V at the time, he was not the emperor, with Mary Rose Tudor. And that's why a portrait painter comes to London in 1514 to paint Mary Rose Tudor and finds this very bad portrait of Charles. That's why Catherine of Aragon brings the Harenbouts and Susanna Harenbout to be her portrait painter and paint a picture of Charles that she gives to him in Calais in 1520, in the summer after Henry and Catherine had been with Francis in Guine. So, I mean, that's the thing. Catherine had one job to do and it didn't end up well. And that's when Henry lost it and decided to go elsewhere and do something else.
And the rest is history.
Oh, yeah. We all know the rest.
So we've been talking about Isabella, and you've mentioned what a powerhouse she is as a ruler in her husband's absence. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular that stands out for you about her when she is ruling in his place that she may have done that we don't know, or maybe we do know?
I think it's not outstanding as a woman, and it's outstanding as a ruler. So I think, and this has got to do more with how I see the women in the Spanish monarchy, but women in general in the 16th century that have power, she has to be the best negotiator in the world because she's a woman. And to earn that respect, she has to do things much better than men. And the way she is able to placate the grandees that are going crazy, because one of the things from this time, unless I forget, is very important that the king had to be present in the kingdom for everybody to be okay. Sure. And Charles wasn't there. So the way that not only she was able to fill in his shoes in his absence, but to tone it down and bring it down a notch with all these crazy guys that are like, rah! It's very telling of what women do. Like Catherine of Aragon does that a lot in England too. But there's other women in other, like, I think the Sisters of Francis the First do this too. It's just the women telling the guys to take it down a notch because they're just getting a bit rowdy. I think this was Isabella's biggest achievement while she was doing all the administrative work extremely well because she was a woman and she was very used to ruling a household, and her mother had ruled her household, and she had been, she was the eldest, so probably, you know, the eldest always gets, you know, is the most responsible, the ones that get, you know, just talking here for the eldest children. I'm from the foundation of the eldest children that always get, you know, all the brunt of the responsibility of learning, right? All those things from your mom. So I think because of such good administrators of their household, then the kingdom is not a big deal. But I think those two things. So a very efficient administration and very capable of taking it down a notch in a very violent time. That, yeah. You know, very important.
She seems very capable.
Yeah.
And I wonder, how was she as a mother?
So I think that, you know, we have to realize in this time, mothers were not like mothers are now. Right? So we have to think more of them as they are in the royal families nowadays. They do have a public role, and then in private they get a lot of help from other people. So, and especially if they had boys and girls, was different. So in the case of Philip II, the second he's a boy, he has his own household. So he sees his mom and all these things and his mom, but it's more, I think they lead by example. Isabella was more a leader by example, you know? So what she was doing had an impact on her son because that created prestige for him.
Sure.
And then he, well, not only that brought prestige to him, he eventually became the king of Portugal. Philip II of Spain became king of Portugal and unified the Iberian Peninsula like his grandparents Isabella and Ferdinand had hoped for. And that was only because, or that was because he was the son of Isabella of Portugal. So she's also bringing that, the dynastic rights, because we've talked about this before, in the Iberian kingdoms, women can rule, can transmit those rights to. So Isabella, is she close to Philip? Not like we would think so, probably. But yes, like we would think of, I don't know. I think a lot of, for example, the late Queen Elizabeth II and her way of showing what a woman can do by leading by example, right? And just setting the standard for everyone else. I think this is what these women and Isabella did for her son. I don't think that she was particularly close, but because none of them. We do have glimpses of them being close to their children, and they certainly took on the education of their children. But you have to think that these women were, had a protocol around them 24/7. So it's not like nowadays. I don't want you to think that she was like, you know, playing around with him and this and that. No, probably they were tough in a sense of this is your duty. This is what you have to do. Things like that, you know? But I like Isabella a lot. I think she sounds like a figure and someone that was very similar to her aunt Catherine, had that kind of like nice temperament that everybody felt comfortable around her. She was very beautiful. I think that helps, you know. And then, I mean, this court is a very luxurious court. So she's always presenting herself also in this manner that everybody, how are you not going to listen to the woman who's shimmering and, you know, has a glorious gown and is, you know, yes, and the biggest jewels. Yes, she's in charge. I'm going to listen to her, you know. So I think that's what she did, just become a good role model.
So that's,
and then her vast collection goes to her daughters, and that gets spread in throughout Europe, because we have to think that when these women die, they own this stuff they have, because this is not England where everything goes to the husband. So then her daughters inherit this, and then they go on to other places in Europe. So the spread of the art produced in Spain by foreign artists many of the time. So a lot of dissemination of the art in the Renaissance and these new ideas on education, female education, all of this. She was involved in this. So that's why she was part of the itinerary of the female perspective, that's the initiative that the Prado Museum has, because the Prado Museum comes from the Spanish Royal Collection. it's very important to know that these women contributed to what today we have in the Prado Museum. And Isabella's portrait was part of this itinerary. So you can, and you can download this still from the internet, because they have an amazing website for the female perspective, but in Prado Femenino. And you can walk around the museum following the itinerary to see these amazing women. Not only their portraits, like the one of Mary Tudor I wrote for that one, but also the works of art, like works of art by Titian. For example, everybody always thought that Charles V was Titian's main patron of the arts, and he was a patron of the arts of Titian, but it was Mary of Hungary who was the person to own more paintings by Titian in the 16th century. And we didn't know about this before. Now we know with a lot of the work in Prado Femenino. And Prado Femenino is directed by my advisor. So this, and this means that it's also interlinked to what we do in Arte Podere Genere, which is to understand the role these women played in the dissemination of Renaissance art. So we work a lot with women like Isabella, but also in the dissemination. And we have a specialist in this, several specialists, but one main one, Melania Soler Moratón, who studies these, she calls it líneas matrilineales. So the instead of, you know, we always think of the Tudors going from Henry VII to Henry VIII, but I think a lot about Elizabeth of York going to Catherine of Aragon. This is what Melania does in Spain, Isabella of Portugal to her daughters and beyond. And all these women then have daughters. So this artistic exchanges and all things get very complex because women are also involved. That's basically what we do in a nutshell.
I love that we're talking about women. And now you've mentioned her daughters, and that was going to be my next question is, Philip wasn't their only child. How many children did they have together?
Oh, wait, let me Google. Because with these women, you never know. They have a lot of children. A lot of them die. So it's difficult. Yeah. They certainly have a lot of pregnancies. And Isabella was one of them. But in her case, she had two daughters. And I wanted to get this right. That's why I was looking at it. But if you want to check on all of this, you have to check out Melania Soler's Moratón's work. And so she had one who was Maria, Holy Roman Empress. And then who became Holy Roman Empress, and then Juana that became Princess of Portugal because she was born to the Portuguese king. Also, we have another person in Arte Podere Genere, Alicia Sempere, who is studying the gift exchanges between these women. So this is something that has been actively researched. People are actively researching on this right now. She did a research stay in London last year, and she's finding amazing stuff. So each year, for example, we have a conference where we study these women from a different angle. And this year is going to be devoted to devotion. So the way these women lived their religious life, which is very important because it's very interlinked to art. You have to think that this is a confessional time in Renaissance Europe, the same way like in Tudor England, we study the prayer books and all these things. In the case of the Spanish monarchy, it's usually a lot more things. And this year's conference has, you know, and you can, we certainly have our registration open. You guys can look at the program in our website. But we have, for example, we'll have women, we'll have talks about women alike, for example, Anne of Brittany, who has an amazing book of hours, or the daughters of, or an amazing place. When you go to Madrid, you have to visit the monastery of the Escaltas Reales. And this was founded by one of Isabella of Portugal's daughters, Juana. This is an amazing monastery full of portraits of the Habsburgs, and became the convent of those noble women when they were widows, and all that. All those powerful women came with their art collections into this amazing place that you can now take pictures in. And it's next to the Prado Museum. I mean, I'm basically just helping you to decide to go to Spain this year, right? And Lisbon. Don't forget Lisbon.
Yes, do
we
not.
We could do an itinerary, Isabella of Portugal itinerary.
Very. Oh, you know, that would probably be pretty big. You better get on that.
Yes. We'll have to tour. That would be amazing. I wouldn't mind.
Yes. I think we know some people who could make that happen. So we'll have to talk about that a little bit more.
I'm already drooling over it.
One of the things I noticed while you've been talking is naming conventions. And as a genealogist, I've been a genealogist for over 20 years now. In the U.S., I saw the traditions of the firstborn son being named after the grandfather. Mm-hmm. And now here we are talking about all these women, because in America, you don't necessarily see that happen with the women as much as you do with the men. The women aren't necessarily named after their grandmothers and stuff like that. So we see a lot. I mean,
unless you're me, because I named my daughter after her grandmother.
I didn't know that.
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love that. And she's
my daughter's
adorable.
Name is Susan, just like my mother-in-law who passed away many years ago. So yeah, Susan has her name from her grandmother.
I love that. Okay, yeah. So the Spanish monarchy, it seems like they did name their children after women in their family. Can you elaborate on that anymore?
I was just thinking, and I'm named after my mom. It's a typical thing in Spain. So I guess that tradition probably comes from that. And I was thinking of one of the most famous books in Spanish literature. It's not a Spanish book. It's from Colombia, Cien Años de Soledad, Gabriel García Márquez. And this book is very difficult to read because everybody's name is the same. So it must be something Hispanic, maybe. I think so. Like my grandmother's name was Pilar. My eldest cousin's name is Pilar. So yes, this is a Spanish tradition, I guess. I never thought of that way. And yes, we do have, for example, we know that certain names get repeated because, in the case, let's talk about Catherine Aragon, because of a certain right timing when you're born. Right. Yeah. So if you're born right at the time that there's a new king of England and you just had a baby girl, you're like, oh, he's going to have a child soon. So if I name something that is going to be like, ooh. So in this case, she was named after Catherine of Lancaster, Isabella of Castile's English grandmother, who had been a very strong woman and a ruler in her own right. Not in her own right. She had been a regent, but she had ruled Castile. But yes, in other cases, it was because of this devotion that we're talking about. Because, for example, let's take Isabel. Isabel had Isabella of Castile. Her first daughter is named after her. And then her son and her second daughter are named basically the same, Juan and Juana. And this is because, in this case, in the court of Isabella and Ferdinand, they were very devoted to St. John the Evangelist. So it's got to do a lot with devotion and inheritance and history. Another thing that I've seen, for example, in Tudor England, when Catherine of Aragon becomes queen, there's a lot of, I don't know if you've noticed this, a lot of people start to be called Francis. Oh, Frances.
Oh.
Frances Brandon. St. Francis was Catherine. She belonged to the lay branch of the Franciscan order. She wanted to be buried with the habit, and she was a devoted member of the lay branch. So a lot of people, to show the connection to the queen, would name their children with names of saints that the queen was associating with. So
I never knew that. That's very interesting, Emma.
That's when you bring in the Spanish perspective to the Tudor dynasty. It's just incredible. Plot twist. You never thought.
I love it. I do find it interesting. And I'm glad that you explained the John the Baptist thing. Because I thought.
And Catherine becomes a very popular name. Sorry to interrupt you, but doesn't it?
It does.
Catherine Parr.
Yes. Catherine Willoughby. Like, we could name hundreds of Catherines from that time.
Oh, and another thing, in the case of the spelling, I get a lot of hate for using the C. And I see why. She did sign as Catherine with a K when she was in England. We have to remember they don't have always the same spelling. So she spells her name different ways throughout her life. When she's an infanta, she spells Catalina with a C and with a Y, not like we write Catalina exactly now in Spanish, but very, very similar, because Y and I sound the same in Castilian Spanish. But in the case of in England, she writes it many ways. I mean, she writes things many ways. She writes things phonetically a lot. For example, when she's talking about Hampton Court, she spells it phonetically in Spanish, Anton Court. I think more for the person who is going to receive that than herself, you know? because, you know, if her dad is going to read this for an environment, what does he know, Hampton Court? You know, he doesn't, or things like that. In the case of the K, she does adopt the K, and that's what, that's the initial that represents her. The reason why I call her Catherine Aragon with a C is when I first started, and I have always admired the biography of Garrett Mattingly, and that's the way he named her there. And that, I think that was the naming convention at the time, the most used, also in Francesca Claremont's book 2 years prior to Mattingly. Those are the most influential books in biographies in my research. So I started many years ago with that naming convention, haven't moved from that since, and I'm scared of doing it, maybe because it's like, well, you know, it's you have to be consistent, you know? So you can spell it with a K. And that was the initial that she, let me show you right here, guys.
Yes.
The K is always here.
Oh, I love it.
So, and we do see it in a lot of the artifacts, right? Like that amazing heart-shaped, I bought this in honor of that, by the way. That heart, do you remember the one that came out that was found last year? The K is present in that. We have it in manuscripts. We have it in Henry's armor. We have it in many places. But she had used the C too, and it has been a naming convention with you. So this name thing is very complex, isn't it?
Oh, it most definitely is. We get the same thing with the Queen Consorts of England as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't tell you how many times people ask me, why do you spell Catherine Parr's name the way that you do?
And for me,
I just chose to because that's the way I've seen her signature. So I stick with that.
Do you want to know something really cool about a connection between Catherine Parr and Catherine Aragon?
Oh, please tell me this.
Okay. So Catherine Parr's mother dies in 1529, Dame Mort Parr.
Yeah.
She was one of the closest ladies to Catherine of Aragon. She was one of the women that was closest to her. She always got her lodgings next to the queen when they moved around, so she was very close to the queen. When Maud Parr dies, she leaves her daughter, future Catherine Parr, two miniature portraits of Catherine and Henry VIII.
Oh.
Think about this. Yes. Then Catherine Parr would be the queen to bring back Susanna Horenboot, who I just said was that portrait painter that Catherine recruited from the court of Margaret of Austria to paint a portrait of Charles. And then eventually she would become queen. So Catherine Parr would become queen of England and use the Horenbouts again. So there's a connection. She had those miniature portraits, and only the Horenbouts were painting those at the time. So the ones that Dame Maud Parr had been painted by Susanna. This is how cool that is, right? And the connection between Catherine Parr and Catherine of Aragon. I mean, I know that Catherine Parr was reformed and she had her religion, but I think the example of Catherine of Aragon as a queen, and I do a lot of this, detaching the religion from what is the construction of the image of female power, what is that seeing someone being powerful for many years has an impact on the way you see yourself and the potential you have, right? So I think in that sense, Catherine of Aragon had a big influence on Catherine Parr. And I'll give you another one. Catherine of Aragon, you know, this is something that it has not been said before, but she was attributed written works by at least one of her biographers. And those written works have very similar titles to the ones that Catherine Parr wrote. So my theory now, I'll just say it because it's I think it's going to be proven, is that Catherine Parr, did she write the books that she wrote, or was she translating from Latin into English?
Whoa, that's scandalous.
Is it? I don't know. I don't follow the Tudor court that much, so I don't know.
I feel like Catherine Parr has been put on this pedestal about being this.
Oh, you really? Know. I never noticed that.
Yeah, when it comes
I'm only kidding. Yeah, of course, I know. She has to be. She has to be in the pedestal. I mean, you know, maybe because she admired so much these works, she was like, these need to be in English because, you know, they weren't written in English, so nobody's going to be able to. And because Catherine did this transformative This is not an episode about Isabella of Portugal anymore. Welcome to the episode about Catherine Parr, Catherine of Aragon, people. Who doesn't like a little rabbit hole? But I think we tend to see them as like confronted because they're different religiously, but this is a continuum. Catherine of Aragon did a lot for women's education. So Catherine Parr is a consequence of Catherine of Aragon's role educating the women in the Tudor court, that's next generation. Even if Catherine Parr was away for a long time, the court was the court. And when she came, that it had been transformed. So they were advancing on something that was previous, not because Catherine was Catholic. It means that everything that she did, they thought, oh, that was, no, they were building off the Catholic faith. They weren't starting a new religion. They were still Christians. You know what I mean? So, and that's what they believed in. They believed in that these amazing things should be in the vernacular. So I wouldn't be surprised if instead of writing these, she would have translated. Not that she, I'm not saying she didn't, she wasn't an author. What I'm saying is, in these cases, it seems like they could have been translated from original works of Catherine of Aragon in Latin. That's what I'm saying.
Well, it's not like she wrote at the beginning of the book, I'm translating this from Catherine of Aragon, who my, you know, existing husband.
That's typical. That's typical because there's a work attributed to Henry VIII called The Instruction of the Christian Man. And there's a book by Juan Luis Vives, and he never said, I am just copying Juan Luis Vives. You know, and Juan Luis Vives wrote The Instruction of the Christian Woman. So they didn't feel the need sometimes to say these things. So it's just a theory, people.
I love when you come to the show with
these
theories.
Please don't post my address because I think I'm going to get a lot of hate.
These are always my favorite discussions because you have you have such a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the Spanish monarchy. And then sometimes you throw out this stuff that I had no idea. And I go, where did you even get this from? And that's why you're one of my favorite guests because of that.
Thank you, Rebecca.
I just never know. So let's get back to Isabella. And
oh, right. Oh, yes.
Before we go too long, let's just kind of wrap up the end of her life a little bit at this point. What can you tell us about how the end of her life looked and how did she die?
So one important thing to know is you can visit her tomb in El Escorial. It's very impressive to look at because it's a monument. It's not just a tomb. And there are sculptures of Isabella and Philip II. This is a very impressive place if you want to, you know, to see a place to her memory. That's the place you need to go to, El Escorial in Madrid. And that's why she's also an iconic queen, going back to why Isabella of Castile is iconic and things like that, because that is an iconic place in Spain. So with that monument, generation after generation, people would go there and she would become this mythical person too. So in the case of that, the body wasn't, so she, when she died, her body wasn't moved until 1574 to El Escorial. So it's also her son constructing her memory. In the case of where she died, I'm trying to look it up because I'm not sure. I know she died in Toledo, but I'm not sure under what circumstances. Maybe I should have looked that up before we started the episode, Rebecca. What do you think?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Gold One knows that your skin changes all the time, like waking feeling hydrated, only to have dry skin after a walk on a cold day, or having dull skin at work, to glowing skin for date night. People don't have one skin, they have skins. And Gold Bond Lotion's clinically proven formulas contain 7 nourishing moisturizers, plus 3 vitamins to help you take care of all of them for all your skins. Gold Bond. Visit goldbond.com to learn more.
Well, she was so young. It does, you know, what did you say? She was 39 when she died. So maybe a little too 39. Old.
So I'm trying to think, I'd look at if it was childbirth or, yeah. or the two main reasons would have been some sort of contagious, you know, the, yeah. the sickness or the, plague like the sweating or, sickness, yeah. plague. But it doesn't seem like it. Let's see.
And 39. Oh, it would yes, be a yes, bit yes.
It was for... she died because a fever, but she was pregnant. So both. She died of both.
Wow. that was quite old for the time to be pregnant.
But that was the seventh pregnancy.
Wow. That is quite amazing.
Her mother her mother died in her last pregnancy too, maybe at a very similar age, because she died in 1517. She had been born in 1482, and she also died giving birth to after she gave birth to her 10th child. So I think overexertion, you know, anyone yeah. that's been pregnant, one of the things that they tell you that's had a baby is don't get pregnant right away. It's not good for you to. And these women were just pregnancy after pregnancy. And some of these pregnancies and didn't end up well. They would have, you know, complications from that. So she did die from a fever when she was pregnant. So it's very sad with these women. Oh. 39 is not it's late, but it was her seventh pregnancy. So it wasn't like it was her first. It's not like with Mary Tudor when she's trying to have a kid at 37. This is a woman that's already had many children. So,
yeah,
still complicated.
Definitely. Well, Emma, what is the one thing that you want people to remember about Isabella of Portugal?
I think that she is the best example of the capabilities of women when you let them in charge, and you need to go and do your own thing in the world, and you leave your woman in charge, and you come back and things are going better than ever, you know. And that's what Charles, that's why he was so devastated. He loved her because she was amazing, beautiful, and all these things. But he loved her because she did an amazing job ruling in his absence. And this is what happens when you educate people, too. So I think it's a combination. She's a good example of what treating women in a different way, like it happened in the Spanish monarchy, entails, and how useful it is for the monarchy, really, because you are not... you're ditching 50% of the people.
Right.
Makes sense? Makes
yeah. sense, right? She seems like she was the complete package for him.
Yes, yes. We say in Spanish, buena, bonita y barata is like a way to say that she had it all, right? So she was yeah. beautiful, but she was also efficient. She was also amazing. She gave him a son, which, you know, in the time is the most important thing. So she gave a Philip II. We all know what he became. So she was amazing, truly amazing.
Well, Emma, thank you so much for coming on today and chatting with us about Isabella of Portugal. I'm sure I'm going to have you back on sometime soon to talk about somebody else from the Spanish monarchy, because this always just opens the floodgates for me to want to know more.
Yeah, well, Isabella in Portugal, amongst other things that we talked about, sure. Thank you. Thank you so much for bringing me. It's always a pleasure to be here in the show. So anytime, I can be back. Have a great day, people.
The Tudors Dynasty Podcast.